Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and Dermot Cole, who's joining us from Fairbanks of the Alaska Dispatch News. Paul, inmate deaths lead to a public hearing before lawmakers here in Anchorage. Department of Correction leaders and union representatives spar. Tell us more.
The Department of Corrections have had, I think it's five young inmates die while in custody between April and June of this year. They've had 148 deaths, I guess, in that system since 2000. What they'll tell you is that the numbers aren't atrocious when you compare them to other prison systems, although our number of inmates is substantially lower. I think the percentages are probably about the same. Most of those, 91 of that 148 since 2000, were from trauma, suicide, or really serious illnesses.
You don't die of old age in prison.
I know someone who used to work in a prison. A year in prison is worth 10 on the outside. So. What they're looking for, I think, the parents, relatives of these young people were concerned about information they were getting from DOC. DOC admits it's been poor, has a poor record of getting information to relatives after someone passes away, which may be part of the problem. But they're looking for the parents, I think, and the DOC really didn't seem to object to it too strenuously, is a third-party independent overview of inmate deaths, which I guess I'm surprised. It's one of those things you go, huh? We don't have one of those already. So I that's where that went.
And part of this is the story is it's kind of traditional in corrections that the corrections officers have a very different view than the administration.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. I think this is one of those deals that they're working right now on redoing the rules and procedures and policies. They say they'll release those. They'll declassify them, I think, is what they said, and release them. So we'll see what those are. But I think in the future, you're going to see at least legislation pushing for a third-party overview, which is, you know, all in all, probably not a bad thing.
Okay, Tim, we have some new developments on the proposed Pebble Mine in Southwest Alaska. EPA News, what can you tell us?
Michael, Friday morning, this has been long anticipated. Friday morning, the EPA Region 10 issued its proposed restriction on Pebble to preempt development in an area that the mine would occupy. And what's different, what we learned Friday morning, is that the EPA is targeting a very small area right around where the mine is. Previously, there had been concern that they would try to preempt development of the whole Bristol Bay region, which is, as we know, is an area as big as many states. The Pebble Partnership has previously filed a lawsuit about this. The states joined it. The state argues this precludes development of a valuable state resource on state lands. The area at Pebble is actually state land, and it's zoned, classified for mining development. So this is another step in the process. EPA said that this is still a proposal, that the rule will take about a year to process.
But now what's the dimension of the area we're talking about right now, the property we're talking about?
Well, it would be, I forget the number of acres, Michael, but it would be the area that would be affected by the tailings and the fill that would be deposited by the mine at the headwaters of the streams. And that's the issue with the mine, is that it's right at the headwaters of streams that affect, you know, support salmon. So it's not a large area, but obviously it's if you pick the exact area where the mine would be, it creates a problem for you. It also might complicate the state's lawsuit because it's a smaller area. It's not the broad area that was originally.
And what's the next step in the process?
Well,
for either permitting or not permitting the mine?
Well, the company hasn't filed its permits yet, and that's another factor in this. EPA has never done this before, where they preempted a project before permits have even been filed. Now they will argue that they have, but there was a case in Florida that they cite, but. That really the circumstances around that were a lot different than in the case of Pebble. So the company has not filed its permit application. The company argues, look, you're talking about a mine that is hypothetical. We may do it differently. Let us go ahead and file our permits. But and Senator Begich, of course, weighed into this immediately and said, well, if there's nothing that stops Pebble Partnership from filing their application anyway, even with this proposed ban from EPA. So we'll see how all this shakes out.
Okay. Dermot Cole, the fight over responsibility for the North Pole sulfane spill continues at the refinery up there. What is the latest iteration of this three-way battle between two major oil industry firms and the state of Alaska?
Well, Mike, it's the sulfalane, as to refresh everybody's memory, is a solvent that was used in the manufacture of gasoline from 1985 or so until just this year. And over a period of many years, some of this solvent leaked into the soil at the North Pole refinery just outside of Fairbanks. And there are varying estimates as to how much, but it's a chemical that's soluble in water, and it has spread far off the refinery property in the groundwater to an area about 3 miles long by 2.5 miles wide. There are two lawsuits that are pending right now. One that has been dealt with by the Superior Court in Fairbanks and is probably going to be appealed, and a second one that is in Superior Court. In the meantime, administratively, the Flint Hills, which shut down its refinery in May, is challenging the state, saying that a lower level of sulfalane pollution, or pardon me, a higher level of sulfalane pollution in the groundwater should be acceptable.
Now, can we go back to those lawsuits? Can we go back to those lawsuits very quickly? Who's suing who?
Okay, in one case, Flint Hills and Williams, the former owner of the refinery, are suing each other, and each blames the other. Flint Hills says it's Williams' problem. Williams said that when it sold the refinery in 2004, it became Flint Hills' problem. In the second lawsuit, the state is suing both Flint Hills and Williams, and the two oil companies are suing each other and the state. So this is a pretty, everybody is to blame, according to one of the parties or other, you know. The state, meanwhile, is negotiating behind the scenes with the two companies, trying to reach a settlement. The most recent development in this is that the parties have agreed to split among themselves, the state, Flint Hills, and Williams. Each would pay one-third of the cost of studying the expansion of a utility system to several hundred homes in the North Pole area. This might cost a total of close to $1.7, $1.8 million split among the three entities. The actual cost of building the utility system could be tens of millions of dollars at least. And there's no agreement on that. And in the meantime, the refinery is shut down, and there is no more sulfalane being dumped into the soil. However, it still appears to be spreading because it is in the site underneath the refinery. And this is a problem that's going to go on for a long time.
Now, the water system you described that would bring water to homes and businesses in North Pole, building that will not do away with the question of who's responsible for the spread of this chemical and for its cleanup, I assume, right?
That's correct. And some of the advocates of building the utility system think that this is a way around that problem, meaning you could live with the pollution level of whatever it is if no one's drinking the water. So that's not quite, and again, let's back up. Note, the state has not set a level on what the acceptable pollution level is for sulfalane.
Okay.
By the way, I might add that the reason the state is involved with this is that the state owned the land up until about a decade ago. And for that reason, as the landowner, the state, you know, bears responsibility under state law.
Okay. Tim, you have a lengthy piece on the evolution of Alaska oil taxes. What do you want readers to take away from your series?
There's a lot to it, Michael, and the I think what people are going to take away from it is it's very complicated, and there's nothing really that I think in the closing weeks of this Proposition 1 campaign that's probably going to add a lot of light to it, because each side, you know, cites a lot of different numbers, and I think in the closing weeks of this, there's just going to be this big blur. But generally, I think what I'd like to have people take away is that there's you know, there's pluses and minuses of both taxes. Both generate about the same amount of revenue. ACES had some advantages. SB 21 has some advantages. A lot of people seem to feel that's going to lead to a reinvigoration of the oil production industry on the slope. Some evidence that that's happening. Oil production's up. Matter of fact, we'll have zero decline this year, which is the first time in many, many years. And that's arguably has been as a result of the new tax. Of course, the critics of the tax say, well, the companies are just pumping up the...
Well, the other thing that's a little bit confusing here is the definition of year, because are we talking about a count that the bill that became SB 21 is went into effect January 1st, so it's only been in effect 6 months, right?
That's right, but the companies knew it was coming. I mean, arguably, it's argued that the companies knew it was going to be in effect, so they started to work right away. In fact,
well, it had passed quite a bit earlier, that's true.
They put rigs to work, and we're seeing the result of that. But the critics of the tax, you know, people like Representative Lescara will say, well, all they did is they just accelerated work they would have done anyway to pump up the numbers to make them look better for the tax rate. But I don't know. When you hire rigs, you spend a lot of money.
Okay, let's get back to Dermot Cole. Dermot Cole, the Hall Road to the North Slope is in trouble. What you call, quote, a moving mass of frozen debris, unquote, and not a small one at a mile long, is moving in the direction of the Dalton Highway. This sounds like science fiction, the blob on the Hall Road. Tell us about this serious matter, actually, of this frozen mass and what it might mean. What can be done?
Well, it turns out that a host of these formations, which have been referred to as slow-moving landslides and permafrost, have been found in northern Alaska, and a couple dozen of them along the Hall Road. This particular item is about a mile long, 600 feet wide, and about 80 feet deep. And it's a slow-moving landslide in permafrost, moving steadily, slowly but steadily, towards the Hall Road, or the Dalton Highway, and to the pipeline. Neither the Hall Road nor the pipeline faced any immediate threat from this because of the distance. Right now, the blob in northern Alaska is about 150 feet, a little bit less than 150 feet from the road, and it's inching its way toward the highway. The Alyeska Pipeline Service Company says that that this is not an immediate problem because the pipeline is on the other side of the road and it's buried there. And they are looking at it, but they don't expect it as a problem in the next few years. One of the difficulties here is that the scientists at the University of Alaska Fairbanks say they're really not sure if the movement of these frozen debris lobes can be predicted. If this debris lobe starts moving in a more rapid manner, it could reach the Hall Road within a few years. And if it does, and if and when it does, really, they say, the amount of material would be equivalent to about 50 tons a day hitting the road. So think of it as having a 50-ton dump, more than a 50-ton dump truck plus removing, hauling away material to keep the road open. That's, potentially a problem. So one of the things that's happening, probably the most immediate thing, is that as part of a reconstruction effort of that part of the Dalton Highway, the state is going to move the road a few thousand feet from the frozen debris lobe to buy some more time. The one issue here is that there are other frozen debris lobes that move quite a bit faster. And if this one picks up speed, then the problem could be more immediate. In the meantime, the scientists at UAF are trying to figure out what exactly causes these, why they move, and what it would take to stop them. One final thing is that the thought is that if it does reach the road, and if you do start removing the material, that just might cause it to speed up and, your problem would get worse. Now, it's a very interesting situation.
I was going to say it's very interesting scientifically because of the makeup of the of the lobe. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about it. As I understand it, it's rock, it's dirt, it's water, it's ice, it's permafrost, and there are even some trees in there that are, that's the way it was, I read it, they're moving yet still alive.
Well, it is sort of scooping up the material in front of it. One of the theories about how it's moving is that there is a layer of water underneath that is below freezing, but because of the pressure, it is not frozen. So the water is cold, but it's, you know, still in a liquid fashion, and that this is helping, you know, cause this, all the material on top of that layer to slide along the surface going downhill. It's really not that well understood. So, you know, the scientists at UAF have told me that they're really still trying to figure out what exactly is going on. But moving the road does buy time. In decades ahead, however, there may be something has to be done of a more permanent solution. They're discussing the idea also, somebody thinking, well, suppose we just build a wall, let it build up behind it. Then the question would be, how strong of a wall do you need to sort of help cut this off?
If we're going that way, I can't resist asking, what about the idea of bombing the blob? Now, right, that would be the scientific, that would be the science fiction answer, right?
Well, that's the real backyard Alaska solution to any problem like this. And, you know, it probably, someone told me, well, it might create a much bigger problem because you'd create a big hole and, you know, you don't know what else you might do to the landscape there. Plus, it might be hard to imagine how the federal regulators would agree with that idea of the bombing campaign.
Okay, thank you, Dermot. Paul, how about an update on the U.S. Senate campaign, and what are the candidates' latest contribution reports?
That would be like a hold my beer, watch this moment, wouldn't it? So it's a kumbaya campaign. These guys all love each other. They're being very kind to one another. No, this is a the campaign is still the Republican GOP primary campaign. It still has taken, Sullivan is mostly taking heat from Begich. He's now started to take heat from Treadwell. Treadwell's finally in the game, taking shots at him. Begich and his independent donation groups, super PACs, have concentrated on Sullivan up to this point. And this past week, they started turning
towards Paul, remember,
Treadwell.
They can't talk to each other because it's not right.
I know this, that would be so, so wrong. But they're turning their guns on Treadwell now. I don't know if they have internal polling that says, wait a minute, this is closer than we thought, or Treadwell and Sullivan are closer than we thought. But for some reason, they have ignored Treadwell up to this point, and now all of a sudden they're turning on Treadwell. Begich took in, I think, 1.3 million, I guess, in the last quarter, which is a little less than Sullivan took in the previous quarter, which was 1.4. Begich has totaled up, I guess, 4.6 million just in his campaign. That's not independent expenditure. To Sullivan's 2.6, Treadwell's got about 900,000, and Joe Miller's got 164,000, something like that. Okay. But the spending is just starting, and the money is just now going to start coming in. So it's New York Times estimates $20-25 million just in outside expenditures in this race. So you're talking huge money here. This is like another industry for Alaska.
Yeah, and for some people it is a gravy train. Dermot, a successful missile test over the Pacific increases the likelihood that the Defense Department will spend $1 billion, that is, yes, $1 billion, to add 14 missiles to Fort Greely silos. Explain.
Well, just to refresh people's memories again on this situation, the one part of the U.S. missile defense system is based at Fort Greely, about 100 miles from Fairbanks off the Richardson Highway. There are 26 missiles at the moment in the U.S. ground, in the mid-course portion of this system. Now, these are missiles that would be launched to intercept a missile coming at the United States in outer space. And the there are no warheads on these missiles, but there is a device that is designed to separate from the rocket when it gets to space and then hones in on the incoming missile and knocks it down. It's been referred to as a bullet with a bullet. Hitting a bullet with a bullet. The test in June involved a launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, a rocket that was successfully intercepted a target that was launched from the South Pacific. Now, one of the complicating factors here is, two of them really, the Obama administration is moving ahead with adding 14 missiles at Greeley. These will cost around about $75 million each. They also pretty much generally agree that the missiles need to have a new object on the top of them. It's called the EKV, which is the exo-atmospheric kill vehicle. They believe that the kill vehicle, which is the device that separates from the rocket that goes after the incoming missile, they believe that has to be redesigned to be more robust. There have been a series of studies that have said that the current kill vehicle really isn't up to snuff and should be replaced. One of the debates right now is, should these missiles go into Greeley by 2017 with the current kill vehicle, or should that be delayed a bit and put a new kill vehicle on them by 2019 or 2020? Just this week, Senator Begich said he succeeded in getting $30 million into the defense budget, proposed defense budget, to increase missile defense just a bit. That's a small part of what it would take to actually get this work accomplished. The funding hasn't been approved just yet, but there's the Democrats and Republicans have been big fans of missile defense. And in Alaska, it's, because of the spending, I think, in particular, people have been in favor of it.
And I might just say that it seems to me that what we've got here, except for the Congress involved, is a duel of elites. Elites' opinion that's in favor of it, and elite opinion or expert opinion, university opinion that's against it. Isn't that the way it shapes up?
I think that's true. I mean, the average person in Alaska doesn't seem to be aware of this system other than reading about it now and then. It's interesting to note, though, that the main reason it's here is because of Senator Ted Stevens and Senator Dan Inouye, because when this was being studied in the 1990s, the statement was made that you could protect the United States, or at least most of the United States, by placing this system in North Dakota. However, you could not protect the far end of the Aleutians or or Hawaii by putting it in North Dakota. And for that reason, when those two senators were at their height of their power, they really directed this to get it placed in Alaska. It's odd now that another element here is people in Congress are pushing for another site that would be on the East Coast that would help protect against missiles from Iran, they say. The system in Fort Greeley is also designed to protect and to shoot down missiles from Iran, perhaps, or North Korea or wherever. It is not designed to fend off an attack from China or Russia or any large-scale situation.
Okay, we're going to skip ahead to Tim Bradner. Tim Bradner, Buccaneer Energy is not kaput, not yet, but the company is having a near-death experience through bankruptcy. What's going on?
Michael, just to refresh, Buccaneer is a small entrepreneurial company that came to Cook Inlet a few years ago with really ambitious plans, but a little skinny on the resources. And they ran into problems. They had good luck for a while. We can credit them with finding gas quickly in Kenai Peninsula, and then later in offshore Cook Inlet. And they found that gas. What's important is they were out there exploring when nobody else was exploring. We thought we were running out of gas. We were talking about importing LNG. And here's a small company that came up, explored right where the major companies had not looked, found gas. And that really was a big morale booster for us. Made us realize there's a lot more gas in Cook Inlet. But the company had some bad luck. There was a major investor that didn't come through with funding, and they had some mechanical problems and some management problems. But most recently, the thing that really forced them into bankruptcy was they got into a squabble, a commercial dispute with Cook Inlet Region, in the Kenai gas field, that was the first one that they had found. Siri Cook Inlet owns land adjacent to where they were drilling in Siri. It's kind of a complicated story, but Siri objected to a unit being formed. Then it complained its gas was being drained. It's kind of a mess. And the one of the state agencies that normally straightens out these kind of messes, the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, ordered an escrow of all the revenues.
Well, this is one of the things I wondered. Was this company undercapitalized for the kind of endeavor they were undertaking?
Probably, because they had ambitious plans, but they really they were undercapitalized. But if things had broken their way, and if the Kenai gas field was still producing revenue, it's still producing, but it's just that the money is not, of course, they're in bankruptcy now, but the agency ordered the money to be escrowed, which cut them off from the revenue source.
And so, in 5 seconds, if they got out of bankruptcy, what could they do?
Well, they've already said the assets are going to be sold.
Okay, so that answers that question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Paul Jenkins. Thank you, Dermot Cole. And thank you, Tim Bradner, for joining us here on Alaska Edition. We'll be back next week. Please join us.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.